This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. Taliban insurgents Wednesday captured airports in the Afghan provinces of Herat and Kunduz as they consolidated control, and U.S. troops complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by the end of the month. The Taliban also say they are in full control of 9 provincial capitals and closing in on others. The recent Taliban offensive has seen the insurgent groups seize control of Afghanistan's border crossings with Turkmenistan, Iran, and one of 5 regular trade and travel routes with Pakistan. Afghan security forces have been struggling to stem rapid Taliban gains, which have shocked the U.S.-backed government and its international backers. Meantime, senior Afghan officials are in Doha for an international conference which will discuss the Taliban's blitz across Afghanistan. Abdullah Abdullah heads the Afghan government's Reconciliation Council and is among one of the officials who will attend Thursday's talks. Ahead of the meeting, a Taliban political office spokesperson reported through Al Jazeera television that if the Afghan government wants to further go down the political path and solve the problems through dialogue, we are ready. While the capital of Kabul itself has not been directly threatened in the advance, the stunning speed of the offensive raises questions of how long the Afghan government can maintain its control of the slithers of the country it has left. Zambians head to the polls Thursday to choose a new president, parliament, and local representatives in a general election that analysts say will be a test for one of Africa's pillars of democracy. As always, for more news, we invite you to join us, voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. Sudan's civilian cabinet has resolved to turn former President Omar al-Bashir and other ex-officials over to the International Criminal Court to face multiple charges of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, according to a statement obtained by VOA from the Sudan News Agency. Several news organizations reported that the handover of the court will take place, but no timetable was reported. The ICC issued arrest warrants in 2009 and 10 for Bashir, accusing him of masterminding atrocities in his campaign to crush a revolt in the western region of Darfur. The Democratic makeup of the United States is changing rapidly, with a new report Thursday on the 2020 census expected to show that minorities accounted for all of America's population growth in the last decade, and that for the first time, the number of whites in the country has declined. The Census Bureau in April said the once every 10 years population count showed the U.S. had 331.4 million residents in 2020 and grew by just over 4, make that 7% since 2010. Some demographers say whites could still be the largest single group in 2014, but will likely be outnumbered by a mix of other racial groups, including Latinos, blacks, Asian Americans, and others. Half of more of the population growth among U.S. minorities in the last decade came from Hispanics, who have doubled their share of the country's population over the last 3 decades. Algeria begins 3 days of national mourning Thursday in honor of 65 people, including 28 soldiers who died from wildfires in the country's Berber region. Dozens of fires began scorching forest regions in the mountainsides of Berber on Monday, destroying homes and animals that provided a livelihood for those who lived there. The Prime Minister and Interior Minister both said earlier this week that arson was suspected in the fires despite a heat wave and high winds, that is, fanning the flames. New Zealand, which has completely stamped out the coronavirus, plans to cautiously reopen its borders to international travelers early next year. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the government planned to follow the advice of experts and maintain the elimination strategy. For more news, voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Thursday, August the 12th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. It is election day in Zambia. Thousands of Zambians head to the polls this morning in a highly contested presidential election, and it's also one of the most closely watched elections on the continent.
And for the first time, you have five major political parties all fielding women as their vice presidential candidates. So it's an interesting dynamic here in Lusaka.
That is VOA's Peter Claudi reporting from Zambia's capital, Lusaka. He will join us from Lusaka shortly with more. Activists in Uganda have petitioned the East African Court of Justice in Arusha, seeking the court to compel the government to open places of worship. And a new Amnesty International report accuses the Ethiopian army of systemic rape in Tigray.
This is the first major human rights investigation into sexual violence in the context of the conflict that has been raging in Tigray since November of last year.
Amnesty International senior crisis advisor and author of the report, Donatella Rovera. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, let's go to Zambia, where a police spokesperson says officers have been deployed nationwide in readiness for today's presidential, parliamentary, and local elections. Esther Katongo says the police have also assured voters that they will be protected throughout the election process. This after the police joined the military and some paramilitary groups, including the prison service, to help beef up security during the election period. The move follows recent clashes between supporters of the governing Patriotic Front, PF, and partisans of the main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, alliance in the capital, Lusaka. The violence, which left two people dead, prompted the Electoral Commission of Zambia to impose a campaign ban. The ban has since been lifted following the deployment of soldiers to help the police maintain law and order. Police spokesperson Esther Katongo tells VOA's Peter Cloti that security officers are ready to prevent any violence during the election process.
We said that the police had made their strategy or planning on how we were going to police the election. So we had the initial deployment of police officers who were policed the initial stage of the campaigns. And these officers mainly came from provinces or in their jurisdiction where they operate from. So looking at this period where in which we are, we, according to our planning, this is the, and experience of course, this is the time when we see a lot of activities. And we see a lot of emotions flaring up. We see a lot of anxieties amongst political players. Hence, the need for us, even according to the planning, that we increase from the human resource, from the manpower.
I understand the police deployed new recruits to beef up security. Yes. Talk to me about this.
Yes, actually, they have not yet passed out. They are still undergoing training. That we feel that they are ready to help in policing. So in the beefing up of manpower, we have also included our recruits who are still undergoing training in our three training schools. Then we have got paramilitary, which is a training school. It is referred to as a special support group for the police. And also mobile unit, which is another special support group. So these institutions, they also have other officers who are not deployed in the initial stage. So these are the officers and the recruits who have been deployed now to go and beef up on those that were already on the ground.
I also understand some military personnel will help the police to maintain law and order and to prevent any possible or potential clashes between supporters of rival political parties, because some people say they find that quite intimidating.
It's not about intimidation, because even now, from the time that the military personnel were deployed, we have not heard any adverse report to say that people are being intimidated. we are seeing a lot of people going about their businesses, and what is important is the objective, why it is we're deploying. So in our planning, we included the officers from correctional service, which is prisons. Then we got some from immigration just to beef up on the human resource level that we had.
That was Esther Katongo, Zambian police spokesperson. And this morning, Zambians are preparing to head to the polls in one of the most closely watched elections on the continent. Analysts said that this election will test Zambia's democratic credentials after the incumbent president Edgar Lungu was accused of trying to subvert the will of the people by deploying police and army in the lead up to the elections. Speaking to the media on the eve of the elections, Zambia's main opposition leader, Hakainde Hichilema, called on the security agencies not to, quote, aid a particular party, saying that he is concerned that the country could fall into chaos if the polls were mismanaged. VOA's Peter Cloti, currently in Lusaka to cover the elections, joins me via Skype. Peter, thank you very much for joining us. You're currently in Lusaka, Zambia, where you're covering the election, considered one of the most important elections in the continent right now. Let's start off with what is happening. Why does the ruling party feel like it deserves another term? Well, what is their pitch to Zambians on why President Lungu should serve another term?
Their pitch, or the pitch of President Edgar Chagwa Lungu, is simple: continuity, because the government is of the view that it has provided a lot of infrastructural projects, highways, among other infrastructure projects that make business easy and make moving from one place to the other very easy. The president just commissioned a terminal built by the Chinese, a new, brand new terminal built by the Chinese right here in the capital, Lusaka. So they are banking on it. The president has also outlined economic policies that he says will jumpstart the economy battered by the global coronavirus pandemic that has affected the economy. So they have outlined some of the policies that they're going to do once he is elected, because they feel that the infrastructure project have been significant, and that they've constructed more roads and other infrastructure developments more than even previous administrations since the country gained independence in the mid-1960s.
And speaking of the economy, Zambia's economy has been affected by the pandemic, just like many African countries. I guess issues started well before the pandemic for Zambia. It is the first country in Africa right now to default on their sovereign debts. How much are Zambians talking about the economy as an election issue?
They are talking about it very well, because the opposition's main argument is that they have the men to be better administrators and manage the economy better than the current administration. They accuse the current administration of being unable to solve the myriad of economic and other challenges facing the country. And that is why the president is countering that by telling them, look, I have what it takes. I have these policies. They are yet to bring out any tangible, pragmatic steps. And some of them are even accusing the opposition leader. They call him the candy man, that he's dishing out candies to everybody, promising everything, yet doesn't have what it takes policies, you know, to actualize these promises. So some of them are, you know, say he's a candy man, dishing out promises here and there that he might not necessarily be able to live up to once he is elected in power. But the president feels confident that Zambians will give him a re-election or voting for a new five-year term.
But the opposition has complained that their candidates are not able to campaign in the same manner as the incumbent, even going as far as, you know, the government apparently deploying security in opposition strongholds. What have you seen in terms of police or army deployment around Lusaka, where you are reporting from right now?
Before I arrived, there were clashes between the government supporters, they call them cadres, and supporters of the UPND alliance, the main opposition party here. Two people died. The UPND claimed one of the guys who died is a leading member of the party right here in the capital, Lusaka. So when I got in, I went to the constituency to check out what was happening, and I saw soldiers right there in parts of Kanyama constituency where the violence occurred. And the president is of the view that the military is needed to beef up security, to help the police to maintain law and order. And according to the Zambian constitution, it is only the president who has the mandate to deploy or tell the military what to do at what time. And in this case, he needs them to help the police beef up security and to restore law and order and ensure that any potential violence is nipped in the bud. However, the opposition is saying that the deployment of the troops, one, shows that the Zambian police has failed or have failed to carry out its mandate to maintain law and order and to protect the property of civilians, unarmed civilians, and that, two, it will intimidate supporters of the party because the Kanyama constituency is known here in Zambia as a stronghold of the opposition party here in the capital, Lusaka.
I know few people who have covered the you know elections in Zambia or politics in Zambia. How is this different this time around?
This time is different because the situation is tensed. People are predicting a 50-50% chance or a toss-up. I heard analysts across Lusaka predicting one group as the president winning re-election, and the other that Hakainde Hichilema is going to win. So they are telling me that that is the reason why the tension is so high, because of the anticipated competitiveness of the presidential contest between Hakainde Hichilema, the main opposition leader, and the president. Of course, we also have a televangelist in the among the presidential candidates. So it's pretty a full course here in Lusaka.
That was VOA's Peter Clotty. He joined me via Skype from Lusaka, Zambia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Amnesty International released a report Wednesday detailing sexual assaults against women by Ethiopian soldiers and their allies in the conflict-torn Tigray region. Amnesty has tallied more than 1,200 cases of sexual violence that were recorded by health centers in Tigray between February and April of this year. Joining International Edition, host Steve Miller is Amnesty International Senior Crisis Advisor and author of the report, Donatella Rovera.
Having investigated sexual violence in wars across the Middle East and Africa, this is one of the worst situations that I've come across in more than 20 years doing this work. In addition to the rape and other form of sexual violence, other forms of torture that has been inflicted on hundreds and hundreds of women and girls since the beginning of the conflict in Tigray, particular effort seems to have been made by the perpetrators to inflict maximum physical and emotional, psychological damage on the women and girls that were subjected to these atrocities, durable damage. So rapes were very often gang rapes by multiple perpetrators, often in front of the survivors' families, in front of their children. Women and girls were held for days and weeks in situations of sexual slavery, during which they were repeatedly raped by multiple perpetrators. They were subjected to the forms of mutilation. Some women had nails, pieces of metal inserted into their womb. The rapes were accompanied by ethnic slurs, degrading insults, death threats against the victims themselves and their families and their communities. And these atrocities were perpetrated by all the forces that were acting on behalf of the Ethiopian government. The National Army, the Amhara militias and special forces that were working alongside the Ethiopian army, and Eritrean soldiers who were working, operating in Tigray in support of the Ethiopian army. And they were committing these atrocities from day one all over the Tigray region, and they continued to do so for months and months and months. So we can't say that these are a few rogue soldiers or a few rogue units. This was widespread in scale, in scope, and in gravity, and by, you know, by all the forces. So this is really what we've been investigating and what we've been bringing to the world's attention in this report.
The research in the report also states that there have been over 1,200 documented cases of sexual assault in Tigray over the span of a few months. But I was wondering if you could comment on what kind of assistance and help these women and girls are receiving.
I mean, first of all, these 1,288 cases that were registered just between February and April, and these were registered in those very, very few health centers that are functioning and that exist only in the main cities. So they're only really accessible to a small percentage of the population, because the rural population who cannot get to the big city has had no medical care at all. And many of the survivors we've interviewed have had no medical care at all, no psychosocial support. The humanitarian situation in Tigray is absolutely dire for everyone. Humanitarian agencies and NGOs are complaining every day that they're facing restrictions getting humanitarian aid, including medical care, medicines, and supplies into Tigray. So the treatment and the assistance that is available to the survivor is extremely limited indeed.
That was Amnesty International crisis advisor and author of the report, Donatella Rovera. The Ethiopian government did not respond to a request for comment about the report. And let's go to West Africa, in the Gambia, where the Election Commission says that it has uncovered a major pre-election voter registration fraud. Thousands of voters have had their voters' cards deleted from the electoral register after being caught registering multiple times. The commission says that such a magnitude of voter registration fraud has never been recorded in the country. Pan Derimbai reports for VOA from Raleigh, North Carolina.
A pre-election voter registration fraud has been uncovered in the Gambia. Over 3,000 people have registered multiple times during the just-concluded voter registration exercise, according to the chairman of Gambia's Independent Electoral Commission, Ali Mamarinjai.
People will register in one registration center, then move from the area and register there. So this has been done deliberately, 2, 3, or 4 times. Nearly 3,000 of them. Can you believe that? Over 3,000. Over 3,000. And they're just doing it instead of voting once for your candidate, you want to vote several times. And over 3,000 people did that. So these are things that have been detected at the database here.
About 1 million people have been registered to take part in the coming elections scheduled for December 4, 2021. Njai tells VOA that some of the registered voters were trying to cheat their way by registering multiple times, but they ran out of luck when the IEC database was reviewed.
The database supervisor will make sure that all those people who have more than once are detected, because they have a system that will match the photo or the fingerprints. Once that is done, we will then have to delete all those people, because it is not by mistake, it's deliberate. You want to vote more than once, and the voter's card allows you only to vote once. So these people who've done this deliberately will have to lose the opportunity of voting.
When asked by VOA as to whether the people behind the alleged fraud would be charged, Njai had this to say.
No, we're not going to prosecute them. That's a little too much. What did they do? No. They just look at their voting right, period. Because these are things they don't do by mistake. It's deliberate. They want to vote twice, three times, four times. They just lose everything.
Njai says the voters were acting on their own, and he pointed out that there was no evidence available to suggest that the voter registration fraud was spearheaded by political parties. Njai notes that despite such voter registration irregularities, the elections would be conducted fairly.
As I always say, our system is such that no matter where in the world you are, whether America or England or Germany or wherever, we have one of the most transparent, accurate, and credible election system in the whole world. Because this voter registration, which enables you to have a voter's card to be able to vote, is done in the presence of party agents. And they have the right to complain or to query anyway they feel is not entitled to. And then these are things that the revising courts will have to address.
The revising courts are empowered to examine and validate the IEC electoral register. It has powers to cancel voters' cards that have been issued to voters who are not qualified to vote. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Activists in Uganda have petitioned the East African Court of Justice in Arusha, seeking the court to compel the government to open places of worship. They say the restriction imposed on places of worship violate their constitutional rights. Reporter Mugume Davis Kwakarinji has more from Kampala.
When the Ugandan government started easing up lockdown measures introduced in June to stop the spread of COVID-19 at the beginning of this month, places of worship were instructed to remain closed for a further 60 days. Petitioner, Kampala lawyer and activist Abakar Hassan Matanda says he believes the East African court will instruct the Ugandan government to open up places of worship such as mosques and churches.
We are hopeful that court can analyze these standard operating procedures and bearing on the duty that the state has in the East African community. They are checked and quashed and places of worship are unconditionally opened to operate, of course, following the standard operating procedures, such that people can get spiritual nourishment, such that the vulnerable in society can get help, such that we can be reminded of our humanity and our eventual accountability to God to support one another and we overcome this pandemic.
Matanda calls it, into quotes, unreasonable that other places which gather many people, such as business premises and markets, are opened while places of worship are closed. Bishop Balo Jack Anthony, another petitioner, agrees. He says the continued closure of places of worship yields overwhelming negative effects on the society.
It is not permission granted by the government. It is a right that every human being possesses, just like the right to breathe. The numbers of suicide have gone up. The numbers of domestic violence, teenage pregnancies that arise from some very embarrassing situations like incest, out of incest, are also up. All of these things are things that the church could address and has the opportunity and the power to address.
Lawyer Daniel Wadimera is representing the petitioners at the South African Court of Justice.
Uganda is a state party to the East African Treaty, and consequently it has obligations through the East African community. And one of those obligations is the rule of law and good governance. And consequently, if you talk about the rule of law and good governance, then obviously you cannot leave out the fundamental right to religious freedom and belief and conscience.
Places of worship are also closed in neighbors Rwanda as a measure to curtail further spread of COVID-19. The Ugandan government is expected to tender their submissions within 45 days. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji, Kampala, Uganda.
And that's it for this Thursday, August the 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We want to thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clody, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington wishing you a very good day ahead, Africa.